Actually, I used to call this how to be physically fit for the spiritual battle. How to be physically fit for the spiritual battle. Because I think that if you're in here, you all want to be able to do as much as possible, at least as much as the Lord wants you to do. And we all usually want to do more than that. We always have great ideals for ourselves. And when we're feeling bad, and maybe our husbands or our wives are expecting more of us, sometimes it's physical. It can be other things, but physical is one of the important parts of our balance. And I'm going to help you in that physical aspect. I have always had a desire to make my body worthwhile to be the temple that it is for the Lord. And one area of this is physically. And that's why I'm in it today. As a student nurse, I sat in back of my class, in the class that I had in nutrition, and I laughed behind my hands with some other girls at the teacher and everything that was being said. I felt it was just not relevant to me. But about 6 or 7 years later, after I'd been married for a few years and was having babies right and left, and my husband had many expectations, and there were all kinds of things that I wanted to do with the Lord, I finally decided I'd better give nutrition a look, because I was falling apart at the seams. I'd like to start, however, by quoting Dr. Gerald Looney of the Medical College of the University of Southern California, who says, "People today are far better educated in medical matters than they were only 25 years ago. The entire field of nutrition, for example, is one in which patients can often hold their own, to say the least, with their doctors. I teach my medical students to listen very carefully to their patients and to other laymen. That's what good medical practice is all about." Now, I don't know about you, but I've had difficulty talking with doctors. I work with a lot of doctors. I work part-time in a mental health hospital in Hemet, California. I work part-time in a hospital for children with developmental disabilities. I watch how the patients eat, and I've learned a lot of things from it. And I've had a lot of dissertations, shall I say, with the doctors about it, and it's been fun for me. Only now are they beginning to listen. It's interesting, but recently I learned from one of the doctors that out of 4,000 medical schools in the country, that includes nursing and other kinds, only 28 offer courses in nutrition, and the longest one is 5 hours. Doctors get a smattering, for the most part, of what is called a biochemistry or the biochemical, molecular balance or construction of vitamins and that sort of thing. They don't get a lot of practicality unless they look for it. In the past, the things that have interested doctors are research, researches into the area of cancer, heart disease, and so forth. They have not been so aware yet of the important need for preventive medicine. And also the government went along with this and offered a lot of research grants, a lot of money, a lot of help. And so naturally, this is what the medical schools gravitated toward. Just recently, the government finally decided that they were not going to offer any more, or not as many, research grants. It would be more in the area of preventive medicine. The money would come only if the medical schools changed their direction in the area of prevention. Because a lot of people are where they're at unnecessarily, and I'm going to try to show that to you. I want to give you a few medical statistics taken from a remarkable book called Overfed but Undernourished. It's by a Curtis Wood, MD, a medical doctor. He's a renowned physician who became an OBGYN specialist. He belongs to the AMA and to the Pennsylvania Medical Society. He's a life fellow of the Pennsylvania College of Physicians, and he's listed in recent issues of Leaders in American Science. And of all the books, I'd recommend this one the most, because it's written by a medical doctor who has seen it firsthand. There's some very interesting little things I'd like to share with you from this, just briefly to motivate you before we get started. And that, by the way, is my whole objective of this time with you today, is to motivate you, because we can only hit the tip of the iceberg. It's interesting. He found that in the last part of the 1960s, 1.3% of the population of the United States remained sufficiently well in 1 year not to have consulted a doctor. It's only 1.3% didn't have to consult a doctor for an illness. Another index of our national health bill, health, is the drug bill, which now amounts to about $5 billion per year. This was 1969. It's much higher now. From July 64 to June 65, 87,300,000 Americans, which is almost 50% of the population at that time, had one or more chronic disease conditions, like arthritis, heart disease, etc. The incidence of heart disease is rising so fast, it was estimated that 1,500,000 Americans would suffer heart attacks and strokes in 1970. They were off considerably. It was quite a bit more. 32 million Americans who are now alive will die of cancer unless new and effective cures are soon developed. 20 million American adults have lost all 32 teeth, and by the age of 55, half of us are without any teeth of our own. There are now 6.5 million alcoholics, which is an increase of 30% in the last 10 years. This was by the end of 69, first of 1970. Of course, you know that there's a tremendous concern about the number of teenage alcoholics now, and there are several reasons for it. One reason is that we consume so much sugar, and alcohol, as you know, is practically 100% carbohydrate. And we are what they sometimes call sugaraholics. It's hidden in practically every food we eat. There's sugar in ketchup, sugar in hot dogs, sugar in pasteurized cheese, sugar in many canned foods. It's a cheap preservative, and it adds flavor. Or it brings out flavor. So we eat it whether we like it or not, many of us. This very slightest amount of sugar can send some people into a tailspin without realizing it. In a recent study I read of juvenile delinquents that were tested, they found that 99% of them were hypoglycemic, which means a problem with low blood sugar, which means you crave sugar. And it's probably the worst thing you can use to treat for low blood sugar, at least if that's been recent discovery. He says it surprises most people to learn that life expectancy in this country is actually declining rather than increasing, especially for men. And there is some more detail on that, which I don't have time to go into. Those concerned with health services tend to soft-pedal the fact that in 1961, the life expectancy of American men ranked 13th as compared to the other nations of the world, and that of American women ranked sixth. Only 8 years later, we had slipped to a dismal 26th place for men and 12th on the list for women. And yet we spend more money than any other nation in the world on staying alive. And we spend more money on staying alive than anything else that we spend it on. We have fallen to 24th in the world for infant mortality rates in spite of massive financial outlay in this area. Over a 10-year period, the number of patients admitted to hospitals increased 5 times faster than the population increased. One study revealed that 1 family out of every 7 has a member that undergoes surgery in a given year. In the past, as high as 45% of our young men were rejected for service in our armed forces as being mentally or physically unfit. The average woman in American industry loses 12 work days a year because of illness, and the average man loses 8 days. The common cold accounts for 1/3 of the days lost from work. Several years ago, we bought an average of 19 million sleeping pills and took 15 tons of aspirin every 24 hours as a country. A survey involving routine examinations of 10,000 men from top business management, averaging 45 years of age, showed only 1 in 10 to be in normal health. In 1965, the American Heart Association reported that the United States leads the world in deaths from heart disease. We can claim to be at the top of the list in some categories. Among 14 modern nations, the United States has the dubious honor of ranking number 1 in crime. Crime is increasing 11 times faster than our population. So those are just a few things that you can dispute with this man if you'd like, but don't dispute them with me. Next, I'd like to tell you just a little bit about my background, maybe as a source of identification. I grew up eating like the average American. My mother tried very hard to give us what was then called the basic 7 foods. It's now down to the basic 4. They've grouped them a little different. And as you know, that's meat and poultry and your dairy products and your breads and cereals and your fruit and vegetables. But we always top that off with Coke or pie or ice cream or a lot of things in between and before and after. I never finished kindergarten, and I never finished first grade because I was so sick. In fact, by the end of the first grade year, I'd had my tonsils and adenoids out along with my other brother and sister. By age 7, I had bronchitis, hay fever, and anemia. And my family thought this is normal. I mean, we knew a lot of other people had the same problems in one shape or form or another. I never missed a year without bouts of colds and flu, at least every winter. We just expected that as normal. By age 11, I had my first urinary infection, one among many. I can remember asking my mother why our dog never got sick, why only people did. And it wasn't until years later I wondered if it was because the dog ate differently and because every once in a while as I watched him, he fasted for a day or two or he went out and ate grass and refused his food. But it wasn't until years later that I noticed that animals have entirely different habits of caring for themselves. Maybe it's called instinct. Shortly after I was married, I got a job in a doctor's office as a registered nurse. The doctor discovered that my husband and I both tended towards low blood sugar that was being made worse by the abundant amount of sugar that we consumed to increase our energy, that Russ was allergic to a number of substances resulting in asthma, hay fever, that he was close to having an ulcer also. He had a condition called pylorus spasm, in which everything he ate came up at different times. I had 3 pregnancies in 4 years, which resulted in increased physical problems for me. One of the babies died at 5 months. Our first child, Valerie, was continually ill, so much so that a blood test was done that indicated that she had no resistance to disease. She had a condition, and let's see if I can say it, called hypogammaglobulinemia, in which she just didn't have enough gamma globulin to fight against the disease where our antibodies are stored. So she had to have gamma globulin monthly, which on our college salary was kind of expensive. And I remember thinking, why is this? Didn't God intend for everybody to be healthy? Why are so many people sick all the time? So it was about then that I began to pray desperately because, boy, I wanted my husband to finish college. I wanted to be able to help him get through. I wanted to raise my children. I wanted to go into full-time work with the Lord. And I just didn't have the strength or the energy, and the whole thought just simply blew my mind. By this time, we had been with the Navigators. We met each other here at the Glen. And I had great ideals for my future. I could see myself going off into the sunset, serving the Lord. But in this shape and form, I knew it was going to be impossible. My husband and I were at each other's throats continually because we felt so bad. We were running a couple of Sunday school classes at church, a couple of different Bible studies, trying to keep our daughter well. He was trying to take a full load in college and work part-time as an assistant instructor, and I was working from sometimes 8 in the morning till 8 at night in this doctor's office and kind of falling apart at the seams. So we really began to pray about this, and I ran into a lady who invited me to a Bible study, and I finally thought, well, maybe I need to take something in because things just aren't right. And in the course of the study, I ran into several women who had gotten involved in nutrition, and they all said, but shh, don't tell just anybody. But these are the things we do, and this is how it's helped our physical well-being. Well, the first thing they told me to do was to get into the scriptures and study what the Lord had to say about it, because this was a very important thing to me, to find out what God had to say about staying well. And I'd never run across it in my average everyday Bible study in the book of Romans or John or Hebrews. So I did a topical study on health and nutrition in God's Word, and I'm going to give you a few scriptures here on this. There is a book which I think is called God's... what is it? Suddenly escapes me. It's about God's Laws for Health and Happiness, or God's Secrets or Keys to Health and Happiness by a Baptist minister. I'll try to get the title straightened out. I ran off in such a hurry when we left California. I left a lot of that stuff behind, but he gives some terrific scriptural background on health and well-being. He apparently had some terminal illnesses. He was really in bad shape when he got into the Word and studied what God had to say about being healthy. And this did a complete about-face for him, and today he's a very healthy man, by having studied what God has to say. Well, just a few things, because we don't have all that much time, to whet your appetite, and then I'm going to let you study this yourself, which you can do.
Proverbs 16:24, for instance, says, "Pleasant words are like a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and health to the bones." But Proverbs 25:27 says, "Too much honey isn't that good for you." So it's a lot of things in moderation. Sometimes we think, well, sugar isn't good, but honey is all right. Well, it has been found that for most people, honey, for some reason, is better tolerated by the body, sometimes especially in children that are having a lot of trouble adjusting to formulas, babies. Isaiah 55:2 says, "Don't spend or labor for that which doesn't satisfy. Hearken unto God and eat that which is good for you." Now, this also pertains to eating the word, but I think it's appropriate in both situations. Exodus 12:8 talks about that when we eat meat, we should eat it along with bitter herbs, which might be another way for saying tossed salad. But it is known that when you eat raw vegetables along with meat, it does help it digest and settle a little better. Perhaps it keeps you from eating so much because it fills you up a little more. I'm not exactly sure, but I'll let you look that up yourself. Leviticus 3:17 and 7:23 warns us not to eat fat. And of course, I'm sure you've all heard of the devastation of cholesterol and the problems people have with it. It's been discovered that the very leanest piece of pork or ham is often saturated with up to 40% cholesterol. It's been discovered that cholesterol is not utilized by the body unless at least three other substances are present. And those are choline, which is one of the B vitamins, lecithin, and vitamin E. At least these three substances help. Some people have more difficulty than that. The United States has the highest rate of heart disease and arteriosclerosis of any country in the world. And, of course, we eat the highest amount of fat of any other country. Men, of course, are more affected than women, which I am sure you have heard. In Titus 1:12, it's mentioned here that the Cretans, which was used to refer to the Greeks at that time, were accused of being what was called slow bellies. Slow bellies meant gluttons. By one of their own people. And this was in terms of the ministry. In other words, these people ate so much that they were hard to discipline. It was difficult to get them really moving. And you know, you're all in churches where you just can't get people out and doing what they need to be doing. You're all in situations like that. And I'm not going to say the two are related. I'll let you decide that. Proverbs 23:20 and 21 says, "Be not among winebibbers, among the gluttonous eaters of flesh. For the drunkard and the glutton shall come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe a man with rags." And we know that no energy results in poverty, physically and spiritually. Nehemiah 5:14 and 15, 1 Kings 13:8, 9, 15, and 16. These verses all talk about the rich food of the kings. It's interesting as you do an overview of the Old Testament, to discover that the prophets lived for many, many years longer than the kings, and they refused to eat the food of the kings. The kings lived an average of 40 years. When you get back in there and you see them dying off one after another. The prophets lived on up into the hundreds, up to 100 and over, and they ate very carefully. I don't have time to go into that, but that's a whole other study. There are over 37 mentions of herbs in the Bible. And the use of herbs. Herbs are directed in the Bible for the service of man. There are many teas, herb teas. In fact, my family and I have gotten into raising a lot of our own herbs. It's very simple. They're really just weeds. You just kind of drop the seeds and they grow. But it's helpful to know what they do and how to use them. Chamomile tea, for instance, which some of you have heard, is very helpful for good digestion or for soothing or calming people. Comfrey tea, for instance, that is very helpful for asthmatic and respiratory conditions. Genesis 9:3 says, "Even as the green herb have I given you all things." He compares all of the things he's given us with the green herb. It might be worthy sometime to do a little study on herbs and find out how they are used. They are a lot less expensive than penicillin and other drugs and medications. In Genesis 1:29, he talks about seeds and fruits, especially given to us for our meat. Ezekiel 47:12, he talks about leaves were given to us for medicine. "The green leaf have I given you for your medicine," he says. I don't have time to really go through all of these, but I can give you some more later if you would like. We're familiar with 1 Corinthians 11, 29, and 30, where it talks about the Lord's Supper not eaten as unto the Lord. It is the opinion of some people that at that time it became important to the Christians to eat every supper as unto the Lord. And because some of them didn't, it says they became sickly. And some of us eat very few meals as unto the Lord. It's kind of just a little tradition that we say grace, which means bless this stuff we have put before you and keep us from getting too sick from it. Does anybody have an extra Bible? I ran off and left mine on my bed. If the rest of you are interested, there's a fantastic section in Daniel that I almost can't just go by. It's the first chapter of Daniel, starting at about verse 3. You're familiar with this, I'm sure, where during the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon came and overthrew the Jewish people at this time. And the king spake unto Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel and of the king's seed and of the princes, children in whom was no blemish, but well-favored and skillful in all wisdom, so that they could stand in the king's palace in whom they might teach the learning and the tongue of the Chaldeans. And the king appointed them a daily provision of the king's meat and of the wine which he drank, so nourishing them 3 years, that at the end thereof they might be nourished well enough so that they would be worthy to stand before the king. Now among these were Daniel and these others that they mention here, unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names. But in verse 8, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with a portion of the king's meat, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. And the prince of the eunuchs said unto Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who hath appointed your meat and your drink. For why should he see your faces worse liking than the children which are of your sort? Then shall ye make me endanger my head to the king. Then said Daniel to Melzar, whom the prince of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, prove thy servants, I beseech thee, 10 days, and let them give us vegetables to eat and pure water to drink. Then let our countenances be looked upon before thee, and the countenance of the children that eat of the portion of the king's meat, and as thou seest, deal with thy servants. So he consented in this matter, and proved them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh than all the children which did eat the portion of the king's meat. Thus Melzar took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink and gave them the vegetables. Now in this day and age, most people that try to go on a diet like this kill themselves. Our methods of cultivation are different. Our source of food is different. It's a very ticklish thing. I imagine in that day and age, the quality of their food was much better. Sometimes by the time we get our food, it's been in a truck for a day or two, in the supermarket for a day or two, and then in our refrigerator for another week. And all of your C and B vitamins are water and air soluble, and they're gone. There's very little left. And then by the time you cook it and pour off the water, there is nothing left. And then we wonder why we feel so lousy, or why so many people seem to think they have to take a lot of extra vitamins and minerals. One other verse here. If you have your Bibles, turn to 3 John, verse 2. This is the verse that has just been a real encouragement to me ever since, out of necessity, I got into this topic. It just says, Beloved, I wish above all things that thou mayest prosper and be in health, even as thy soul prospereth. Even as thy soul prospereth. I don't think that even needs any explanation. I'm going to skip a few more here and go down to Proverbs 31, 17 and 18. The godly woman who girdeth her loins with strength and strengtheneth her arms. Her loins, as you know, are her inward parts, and her arms are representative of her outward energy or her outward actions. She strengthened her insides and she strengthened her outsides. And as a result, she was able to rise before dark to prepare the food She was able to bring her food from afar. She was balanced, and strength and dignity are her clothing. She was good-natured. She was able to laugh at times to come. One of the first signs I see of people suffering from being in poor shape physically is their nature, depression. Depression is one of the first signs of being in poor shape physically. And working in a mental hospital, that has really been brought home. I just die when I see these people in there who have access to this little kitchen. They can eat anything they want. And, of course, I also serve them all their trays, or I supervise it. And I watch what they eat. And 99 times out of 100, they leave all their fruit. They leave all their vegetables. They will oftentimes even leave the protein food. They just eat the starch. They eat the ice cream. They eat the cookies. And that's it. And these people are all in there, some of them as young as 45, unable to think. They're senile. They're in there with a condition called organic brain syndrome, which means senility. One of the first signs of it is paranoia. They think everybody's against them. Everyone's out to kill them. A couple of times I've met people who were former dynamic, outgoing Christian people who are in there completely out of it mentally, not at all aware of what's happening. This is rather new. The doctors are just dumbfounded that people as young as 45 are being admitted into mental hospitals for senility. But when you examine their lifestyle, they did not spend a lot of time working on keeping themselves physically fit or keeping their temple fit for the Holy Spirit. And so that's something I want to challenge you to get into. I can't tell you all the ins and outs of it, but I hope that you are becoming more concerned about learning it. At the moment, we have four children who are doing fairly well. My 13-year-old that I mentioned that we started out with, has done fantastically. She's after we finally learned how to eat correctly, she went off the gamma globulin and never got sick again. She still hasn't had to have her tonsils out. None of our children have had their tonsils out, except our foster son, who just came to us last October. Our foster son, when he came, had been sick continually, had had continual problem with hyperactivity. He'd been kicked out of one classroom after another. The teachers wouldn't even have him back in. He just finished up this last semester with a special award for being the outstanding citizen of his class. Now, the main thing that we did was change his whole diet, which upset him terribly. That's the first thing. The second thing we did was just be ourselves. And as he gradually got into the spiritual climate of our house, we trust that worked. Although every time he would go home and take a little weekend off to be with other relatives, he would come back impossible to handle. And we would find out what he had eaten and what he had been subjected to, and he would often come back sick. So I know there's a great difference here. If any of you know people that have hyperactive children, there's a tremendous difference just by virtue of diet, of which I wish I could begin to go into here. People are always overwhelmed, too. This is another thing. They're overwhelmed at the thought of changing their diet, and I always say, well, read a little bit, just a little bit before you go to bed or sometime about it. Take a magazine, maybe Prevention or Let's Live or Best Ways, which are different magazines on the physical part of our well-being. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater on some of the stuff you read that just doesn't jive or doesn't seem to click. Pray. Read these things in an attitude of prayer, like everything you do should be done anyway. And say, Lord, help me retain and remember those particular things that are appropriate for my family. Because, like I said, each one of us is different and each family is different. Our family has trouble with wheat, even whole wheat. Some other family may have trouble with milk. You'll read somebody that says milk. Everybody should have milk to drink. But do whatever you do before the Lord. Read it and don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Just consider it before Him. My second child, Travis, who was really my third pregnancy, was born brain damaged. The doctors said that he would probably be a vegetable all his life and would have to be put in an institution, and we better get ready to do it. When he was small, he was practically impossible to handle. He didn't have a single night until he was probably 2.5 to 3 without waking in the night and screaming for hours. We finally devised a little apparatus that was an old motor that came out of a blender or something that my husband set up on a tin pie plate that hit a piece of paper and made a loud noise in his room so that he couldn't hear the other noises in the house, and that way he would sleep longer. But if a sudden, like just the turning of a door handle could wake him up screaming. He could hear noises before we did. He'd hear an airplane long before anybody else heard it, a couple of seconds before. He was very hyper, very emotional, very upset, and we thought, really, that would be it. And plus, his IQ was very questionable as to what anybody had to work with. Today, he's, to all practical applications, he's normal. He's in the fourth grade. He's doing fine. He's smaller than usual. Several doctors said to us, this is the kind of child that should have died of leukemia or should have had 101 urinary infections or respiratory infections or should have been in the hospital many times by now because he has a poor constitution basically to work with. Well, he hasn't had to have an antibiotic since he was 18 months old, and he's almost 11. He's never been to a doctor for an illness since he was a baby. I've learned how, after much prayer and reading and time on my knees, how to work with him. And it takes time. You don't learn these things overnight. My last child, Corina, who's 9, has never been to a doctor in her life for an illness. She's very healthy. By the time I got pregnant with her, I was a little bit down the road, and I knew a little bit more about what to do, how to eat, and how to care for myself. So I want to encourage you by these things that it can be done. It can be done. Let me talk to you just a little bit about vitamins. There's a lot of controversy about whether you should take natural vitamins or synthetic vitamins or whether you should take them at all. And I want to go on the record as saying it's a very individual thing and you'll have to decide that for yourself. Let me give you a little bit of what I've read and then you decide or look into it further. I remember reading a book about a number of our soldiers after the Second World War who had a condition called pellagra, which is a vitamin B deficiency, B1, thiamine deficiency. And it came about from being in the Japanese prison camps and not being fed correctly. So when the war ended, the American doctors made a great effort to send back to the United States for injectable thiamine. It comes in little bottles, and you just draw it up in a syringe and inject everybody with it. When it came back, they did just this. They drew up the thiamine, which just looked like water in a little bottle, and they gave every one of these soldiers injections of it, and nothing happened. They just got worse. Finally, in desperation, they went into the local village and bought sacks of unhulled rice and soaked it in water for 24 hours, took the water off the rice, and let the men drink it, and immediately they began to get well. Now, that's a situation in which people responded better to the natural vitamins. This little book has an interesting blurb on natural versus synthetic. Dr. E. E. Pfeiffer, a biochemist of much prominence, discovered that there was a difference between synthetic and natural vitamins, even if they contained precisely the same atoms. There are compounds that have the same atoms but are arranged differently from the structural standpoint. These are called isomers. Dr. Pfeiffer discovered that some isomers, when in solution, reacted differently to a beam of polarized light. Those that rotated the light beam to the right were called dextrorotatory, and those bending the beam to the left were designated as being levorotatory. An example is two sugars, both of which have the formula C6H12O6. One is called dextrose and the other levulose because of their different response to the beam of light. Dr. Pfeiffer learned that the enzyme systems of the body are set up in such a way that they can efficiently utilize the natural vitamins, which are levorotatory, but tend to reject the synthetic dextrorotatory ones. This little-known fact justifies the opinion that natural vitamins are often better than synthetics and also explains why some people will not respond well to some synthetic vitamins, such as ascorbic acid. Some people will get well or are helped greatly by ascorbic acid, which is just called vitamin C, and others are not helped by ascorbic acid. However, if they take acerola or rose hips, these same people that are not helped by ascorbic acid may be helped. Depends on your system. There are a lot of people that say, I don't know why people think vitamin C is so great, because it's never helped me. It may depend on the type you're taking. Other biochemists have found that frequently synthetic vitamins are in a crystalline form, while the natural ones may be in the colloidal state and therefore more readily assimilated by the human body. These biochemical discoveries do not mean that synthetic vitamins are worthless, as some overenthusiastic food faddists may claim, but they do prove that we need to consider it carefully as to our own bodies. So I'll leave you with that on that. Now, a little bit more on the vitamins. I have some forms here. They're left from another seminar that I had at one time. If any of you are interested, well, I'll just set them down here and let me help yourself to them later. They're kind of a brief resume of what the vitamins are doing in our system in a way that might help you be aware of if you could use more or not. In general, let me just kind of touch on them briefly. Most of you are aware of what vitamin A is used for, but you may not know that it's also important for resistance to infections. Vitamin A is found in abundant amounts in your mucous membranes, in the linings of your body. It helps your skin. It helps the linings. It is also essential to work with vitamin D and E in strong bones and teeth enamel. It also plays a part in appetite and digestion. It also plays an important part in reproduction. People who have trouble in the area of fertility may need more vitamin A. It plays an important part in the formation of our red and white corpuscles. It prevents certain birth deformities, such as cleft palate, or where the bones need to knit together correctly. It delays senility. I knew of a case of a woman that all she did was add vitamin A to her diet, and she came out of some of her very weird actions that seemed to be going along with her increasing age. Deficiencies of vitamin A result in poor vision, especially at night. Rough or flaky skin, you will notice it around your elbows, around the backs, upper thighs. Bumpy skin that feels like you've got goosebumps on certain areas. Unhealthy mucous membrane secretions, certain types of warts. How much do we need? I'm not going to tell you. I have my own conclusion on that, but it's in this book, it's in other books, and it's different from person to person. I'm absolutely convinced it's as different as how big a meal you should eat. I would never tell you that you should eat the same amount of food every day. Neither would I tell you that each of you need the same amount of vitamin A. It's very different because you've all lived different lives, you've had different exposures to different pollutions and different stresses. You can obtain vitamin A from some butter, fresh butter, especially that was manufactured in the spring, has a lot more vitamin A in it. Butter that's manufactured in the fall or winter has less vitamin A. Of course, if you took a bite of polar bear liver, you might drop dead from too much vitamin A. It's very difficult to get too much vitamin A, but because there have been one or two cases in history of people that have died from too much vitamin A, people tend to be afraid of it because those things were blown out of proportion. Nothing is said of the hundreds of people that die from too much aspirin. It should be eaten in the presence of some fat in order to be utilized in your body. Vitamin A that's added to skim milk, for instance, and eaten with a fatless diet may not be utilized. It should be also eaten in the presence of the B vitamins, especially choline, and vitamin E. Food sources should not be canned, cooked incorrectly, frozen incorrectly, or exposed to varying temperatures, or the vitamin is destroyed. Doesn't sound like it's very easy to get it out of your food, does it? Not in this day and age. See, it used to be that people just went out and picked their food and ate it. Vitamin B complex is probably the most important, or the one I think of as the most important, because there are about 15 to 20 B vitamins, maybe more. There are 11 that we talk about commonly. But they are necessary for good digestion, especially the digestion of starch. The more candy or carbohydrate or starch, macaroni, pastries, bread you eat, the more vitamin B you require to handle it correctly, because it's necessary in making hydrochloric acid. Vitamin B is necessary for a healthy nervous system. I have seen several people in our mental health unit get well just by the addition, of vitamin B to their diet. I saw one lady who was having very bizarre behavior improve tremendously just from vitamin B12 being added. I have seen people, and it's almost a spiritual vitamin in some ways, or an imitator, because you can gain even in your self-confidence, in your calmness, your coolness, your ability to handle stress. It's often called a stress vitamin. However, I am not over enthusiastic about popping vitamin B tablets every time you're under stress either. There are foods that are very high in vitamin B still that are very helpful. Drinking cultured milk is one very good way to get vitamin B. We make a milk called kefir at our house. Kefir is produced by a dairy in California called the Altadena Dairy. And you can just pour about that much in the bottom of a quart glass, a jar, and fill it up the rest of the way with regular milk. Let it sit out for 24 hours and the whole thing cultures. It just becomes thicker. It's a little bit more tart. If you don't like the taste, you can blend it with a banana or any fruit you like. But it is twice as well digested as sweet milk. The fact that adults drink sweet milk is very questionable, the health of that, or the practicality of that, because after the age of 2 or 3, we are supposed to no longer have an enzyme with us, or many of us don't have it, called lactase, which digests the lactose in milk. If we don't have that enzyme, then we're going to have a lot of gas and a lot of problems if we drink milk, especially sweet milk. Vitamin B does all kinds of things that I wish I had the time to go into. Even it helps our sense of hearing. It's again important for healthy skin, muscle tone, energy, etc. But especially the whole nervous system is dependent on vitamin B. Other foods that are high in vitamin B are, of course, wheat germ. But if you get wheat germ, get it canned. Don't get it packaged because it starts to turn rancid within 7 days. Well, I'm going to mention one thing here that's a little controversial because I found it such a help to our family, and that is raw yeast. You've probably heard that raw yeast is dangerous. I've never found anything on it yet to prove that it's dangerous. In one of Adele Davis's books, she says, well, it causes a lot of gas. Well, of course, if you put raw yeast in your bread dough, what happens to it? It rises up, it bubbles. Well, if you eat raw yeast on top of bread, what's going to happen? Or sugar? You're going to be full of gas. So if you take raw yeast, it should be taken on an empty stomach or last thing at night or first thing in the morning. But I have had more benefits from raw yeast than any other food I can think of. It has not given me any problems, and I've taken it now for years. At one time, I think during the Second World War, there was a big rush on raw yeast, and a lot of people took it and they spread it on crackers and they got gas. So they stopped it. But I have seen such good results from it in my family that I'm going to dare and tell you this, even though you won't see a lot about it. I don't want you to take it, though, if you have any fear or hesitancy. But it's extremely high, in my opinion, of vitamin B because it takes care of these kind of symptoms that I've just described to you of vitamin B deficiency. Vitamin C, I'm sure you're all more aware of what vitamin C does than any other vitamin because there's been a lot of controversy and publicity about it. It's difficult to take too much of B or C because it does pass out readily through your urine. I have read that too much vitamin C will result in diarrhea, and so that if you get to that point, you know you've had enough. Vitamin D, of course, is necessary for the absorption of calcium, especially in children. You do get it from the sun, but you have to be careful not to wash for something like 4 to 6 hours after you've had a good exposure in the sun so that it has a chance to completely be absorbed into your system. Now, I'm not sure on that number of hours, so erase that. But you do have to be careful not to bathe too soon after you've been in the sun to get the full benefits of vitamin D. You can get vitamin D in fish liver oil, such as cod liver oil. Some egg yolks where the chickens scratch on the ground, for instance, they have found vitamin D. It's difficult to find it in food. It's really not in very many foods. It is added to some food, however, nowadays in a synthetic form. Vitamin E, it is very controversial, vitamin E is. There's a book out by a Dr. Shute S-H-U-T from Canada about vitamin E. You could probably find it in most health food stores. That explains, from his point of view, the fantastic miracles he's seen from using natural vitamin E. Now, when vitamin E was first investigated here, it was made in the synthetic form, and the doctors saw no results, so they poo-pooed it. And so that's a vitamin that has not been readily accepted. I've seen some good results from it. And I really can't tell you dogmatically that the vitamin E did it, so I'm not going to tell you what they are. But in my opinion, I've seen very good results from vitamin E. Vitamin E is obtained in uncooked whole grains, unrefined vegetable oils that are cold pressed, wheat germ, certain raw vegetables, and certain raw nuts. If you can eat your nuts raw, all the better. Chew them well, and best to probably eat them only one at a time, one kind at a time. We'll talk in a minute here a little bit about digestion and the terrific problem that Americans have with digestion and how maybe we can help this a little bit. I was just talking to a gastrointestinal doctor the other day who said he has never had so many problems in his life as in the last year or two. They just increased. The gastrointestinal problems of Americans, he says, is just overwhelming, much worse than any other country of the world. His opinion when I asked him was very interesting as to why this problem. He felt that one major reason was because we eat smorgasbord. We eat so many ingredients in every meal that our system has a hard time digesting them all because sometimes each ingredient takes a different digestive juice. So the ingredient of which you have the most, like maybe it's meat, will be the one that is favored by the digestive juices, and that's the one that gets taken care of. What happens to the rest? It putrefies, it rots, it ferments as it goes through your system undigested and causes gas and all kinds of other problems. It may be one of the reasons why there's so much lower bowel or colon cancer today. Boy, I start thinking this is such a negative thing that I'm talking about. But I hope to end on a positive note, so bear with me. Okay, let me go over here a little bit. There was one more thing here. Oh, calcium. I was going to talk just a minute about calcium and minerals. There is a new test out today called the hair analysis. It's being done here in Denver. It's being done in Hayward, and it's being done in different big cities throughout the United States. But they take a sample of hair from the back of your neck, and they dissolve it and do different things to it and look at it under the microscope, and they're able to tell where your mineral balance is, your body's a biochemical balance regarding minerals and other toxins too, such as lead, mercury, etc. Right during the time that my son was waking up every night screaming, we had this test done. We took his hair sample. Walt and Liette Hendrickson were the ones that told us about it first, and we took his hair sample over to this dentist in town who sent it into Denver. And we found that Trevor was way out of balance on a number of minerals. He wasn't absorbing or utilizing magnesium, nor was he absorbing or utilizing calcium. And there were several other little things, too, that I won't go into. But after we got him on some what we call chelated minerals and some other food supplements and got him straightened out, he never had that problem again. Never again did he wake up during the night screaming. Never again did he act quite the same. Of course, we worked on all the other aspects of his diet, too. But that was one of the most dramatic things. Within a week of starting him on chelated vitamins in which his system was deficient, he changed. Now, there was no way you could look at him and tell he was deficient in anything. And doctors had looked at him and said, no, he's fine, just keep doing what you're doing. He may outgrow it. Would you like some Ritalin? Would you like some Dexedrine? Things like that. And I said, no, I'll put up with it. And I'm so glad I did. Well, anyhow, calcium is something that is often very poorly absorbed, particularly as we get older. And there are lots of different kinds of calcium. Now, this is something I didn't know until recently. I got involved with a group of doctors in Los Angeles, and as you know, Los Angeles has a little bit of everything, they backed an organization called the National Health Federation.
And there were a group of doctors that were very interested in preventive medicine, particularly in the nutritional and the exercise areas to keep us well. And they said there are many different kinds of calcium. There are certain kinds of calcium that only come from plants. There are certain kinds of calcium that only come from bones. Other kinds of calcium, such as calcium lactate, that comes from milk. And that we cannot get along on just one calcium. And that's why it's very important to get a lot of fresh vegetables and fresh salads and this sort of thing. They also said that the calcium is often made unassimilable when it's cooked in foods. It goes out into the water. And when you have a lot of cooked vegetables that you eat, and you say, well, I'm eating a lot of vegetables, and I eat tossed salad at least every other day, you may not be getting enough of a certain kind of calcium that comes out of the food. There are these calciums now that I have found in homeopathic preparations, little teeny white pills is what they look like, and you stick them under your tongue, and they absorb under your tongue. That's another thing I could go into. But anyhow, be aware that you may not be getting enough calcium, even though you're eating or drinking lots of milk or taking a lot of dairy products and even taking calcium lactate. Let me go in now to the problems of getting families to eat correctly. Here we are, and we're all interested in improving our diet, and we have a husband or a wife or children that are just with their backs up against you on the whole issue. Well, I have found that there's several problems here with our eating habits. We have gotten in the habit of eating, number one, eating too much, eating too flavored or too spiced, too seasoned, eating in the wrong combinations at the wrong times, eating too refined, and eating too fast. Those seem to be the six major problems that I've seen. You might also add eating when you don't feel like it. When you don't feel like eating, everything becomes toxic to your system. It's ridiculous to eat when you don't feel like it. When people say, well, you've got to eat, you need to eat because you haven't eaten, you know, that may be the worst time, at least orally. There may be other things you can do about it. It depends on the situation. But many times we do eat because it's the thing to do, because it's dinner time, and so we sit down and eat. On the area of too much, because of the abundance, apparently, of hypoglycemia, or people that have the problem of low blood sugar, and I should mention that I've seen several reports now where they say that the average individual is consuming from 80 to 100 pounds of sugar per person per year in the United States, when just 25 or 50 years ago, it was more like 10 pounds of sugar per person per year. Because of that, when we go without a meal, our blood sugar goes way down, and we get dizzy, and we feel grouchy, and our stomachs growl, and we're very difficult to live with. And it's because of this condition that many people have brought upon themselves, called hypoglycemia, from eating too much carbohydrate. People eat far oftener in the United States than in any other country in the world. Many other countries, they eat once a day, at the most twice. But we have to have our three meals per day. And some of us are bigger and fatter, but not all of us for it. A lot of us just don't digest all of it, and we suffer the consequences of the stress put on our system of extra food that has to go through without being utilized or being utilized correctly. Secondly, because we eat smorgasbord style, in other words, we eat a lot of combinations of food at one meal, we may suffer. I have read now several reports that are new and are controversial by some of these doctors that are involved with the National Health Federation that say don't mix meat, milk, and starch at the same meal. Meat, milk, and starch each require a different digestive juice. Now, if you were born with a real strong constitution, you may be able to handle that for years. As people get older, they handle these kind of combinations less and less efficiently, and they have more and more gas, and they become sensitive. Like I watch my grandparents and my aunts and uncles and so forth say, well, I no longer can eat that much, or I can no longer tolerate this or that. And they're a little more careful. But as I said, milk is used often when as an emergency remedy for when you have had a child or somebody that's ingested a poison, because it keeps and it stops the absorption of what's in your stomach. So when you drink milk with a meal, what happens? You cut down on the digestion of the rest of your food many times. Now, like I said, some people can handle it. Meat, again, is a strong, high-protein food. It requires yet another digestive substance. Starches are broken down by the ptyalin, an enzyme that is secreted in your mouth, in your saliva. And you have to chew starches a long time until they are almost dissolved in your mouth so that they can continue to be handled by your system. Children until the age of 2 do not have ptyalin. And you know what kids are fed from the age of 5 months on? They're given crackers and cookies and dry toast. And what happens? 80% of our children before the age of 5 have to have their tonsils out. Now, I'm not saying that poor digested carbohydrate causes tonsillitis, but it does cause a lot of fermentation and putrefaction in the intestines, which can become a feeding ground for bacteria, which can cause a lot of catarrh or phlegm or mucus, which can infect the lymphoids, which can fill up the tonsils. And so, maybe that has something to do with the reason that 80% of our American children have their tonsils out by the time they're 6. No other country in the world has that problem. Well, anyway, so if you're going to have children, you might consider waiting on the starches or carbohydrates, especially the refined ones and cookies and crackers and that sort of thing, until they're at least 2 and have all their teeth in. God made it so that by the time their teeth were in and they were able to chew, that they would have ptyalin in their saliva. Okay. I have gotten so people say, oh, how can I ever go? How can I ever have a meal without mixing either meat, milk, or meat and starch? Well, potatoes aren't too bad because they are a vegetable. Bread is. Bread is the big offender. Bread with meat is a big offender. You can tolerate potatoes better with your vegetables and your meat than you can the bread. So now automatically our family has our meat and our vegetables and our tossed salad and occasionally a potato. We try to vary it. And we don't drink anything more than water and we with our meals. I'm talking about with meals. And we try to keep the water even to a minimal amount so that we don't dilute the digestive juices. It's good to drink well before meals, or between meals, I should say. The Bible even mentions not to cook or eat meat with milk. I was trying to find that scripture last night, and then I got interrupted and didn't get back to it. But it talks about not cooking or eating your meat with milk. Okay, now let's get into the area of too flavored. I know you all have kids that refuse to eat vegetables unless they're smothered with butter and salt and other things. And even then, it's like pulling teeth. Well, for some of you, it may be a little late, but if you can at least share some of these things with your children and get them convinced that they may need to work on it. This is one thing that helps when you have children that are over the age of, let's say, 5. Generally, sharing with them what you're learning. My kids are very brainwashed. They've learned to be more tolerant of the way other people eat, but they know, and they're very careful for the most part. Now, I can't guarantee that when we come to a conference like this where they really put out the stuff. But for the most part, I can count on them to use their good sense. But it's because I started with them from the time they were born. They didn't have any say about it then. And I just was determined to ingrain good eating habits into them. And the way I did this with my first one, when I finally began to get wise a little bit, was I just decided she would not have any ice cream, candy, cake, or anything like that that really tempted your taste buds, until it was impossible for me to control it. So I blended all my food. I gave her vegetables without any salt or sugar or butter at all. If she didn't want something, we just put it away, and she got it when she was hungry. And she learned to like everything. There's nothing she won't eat. Now that she's 13, she's a little pickier about having a say in what she does. But I can guarantee, my goodness, look at this, manna from heaven. Oh, I think there's a bird's nest or something in here. I just saw a little bird. Well, anyway, my son, Trevor, will eat absolutely anything that's put in front of him also. And our youngest daughter, Karina, who gave us the hardest time with it
which was a surprise to me. She really fussed, and I know all of you are thinking, yes, but you don't know my kid. Well, Karina was one of those. She really fussed, and she said, I am not going to eat it. And we'd say, fine, Karina, that's what we're serving. You'll have it at the next meal then, or whenever you get hungry. And when she wanted a snack, I said, well, then apparently you're hungry for this. Well, maybe I am. And she learned to like everything because we stuck with our guns, and she knew that we meant what we said. And so now, even if we're in a situation where we're traveling and I've got to put some limitations on them, they don't push me. They just say, okay, Mom, and they do it. In other areas, they push me, but they know in that one area I really mean what I say. There are a couple of times when I practically laid my kids down on the floor and held their nose and opened their mouths. Not quite, but they knew that if it came to that, they really thought maybe I would do it, I think. So the biggest thing I can offer to families is to start your kids out on vegetables. Skip the fruits, unless they're raw fruits, but give them the most plain, untasteful, blah stuff you can think of. And when they learn to like that and eat it with relish, then go on from there. But if you start putting, I remember at one point a friend of mine that was putting applesauce on every bite that she gave her child to cover it up. Well, naturally, when the child got old enough, she would not take the applesauce on it. She would take the applesauce plain, or that was it. And I know all kinds of people that have said to me, but my children won't do. They won't cooperate. Well, I say, who is the boss? How important is it to you that your children grow up able to survive in this kind of pollution that we live in? And speaking of pollution, there are many more diseases today caused by pollution, like, as you all know, emphysema, and the people in the L.A. area that are suffering from it. There are some nurses taking classes with me at Cal State in San Bernardino. A couple of them work in an emphysema ward in a hospital in L.A., where everybody has it, and there are people on a waiting list to get in there. I just talked to a very dear friend who used to be on the staff here with her husband, who has a condition called sarcoidosis. It's a new condition caused by pollution or toxins in the system that your body has not been able to eliminate. She doesn't know what to expect from it. The doctors only expect the worst. It's affected her lungs. They are afraid it's going to affect your eyes next. It affects whichever of your organs are weaker, one at a time. So keep your kids from depending on sweeteners and flavors. I know I grew up with all the sweeteners and flavors, and I have a terrible time disciplining myself today. I've got to consciously think, all right, you're not going to eat that today. I have to work constantly on self-discipline. My kids don't have to do it as much because they've been raised on the blah stuff, the healthier, unflavored. They like it just fine. I've had people say to me, oh, you're so mean to your children, making them eat like that. Well, it all depends on how you look at it. Eating at the wrong time. If you wake up and it's time for breakfast and you don't feel like eating it, and some people are really going to disagree with this, I say don't eat it. Eat when you feel hungry. Now, you can't always do that when you're going to work. If you're going to work and you have a limited amount of time, you might want to just eat something that's very readily digested. I have a drink that I make in the morning for those busy days that is very readily digested. If I'm going to be home, I wait and I eat when I get hungry. And I plan ahead on what it's going to be so I don't succumb to something that I really didn't intend to eat. It's been found that people, that there's a certain time of every day that each one of you digests your food better than any other time. And no two people are exactly the same. Although you can be within a few minutes of each other, so it's not all that bad. But there are certain times when you handle your food the best. The more fatigued you are, the less efficient is your digestive system. And when we eat at night, like 8, 9, 10, midnight, and especially when we eat snack foods, that's very hard on you. And those are the times when you'll wake up the next morning feeling, yikes, why did I eat that last night before I went to bed? Why did I take that bowl of ice cream that last minute? You could have handled the ice cream great about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but you were busy then. It's more fun to sit down and watch TV with a bowl of ice cream and a bowl of popcorn.
And sometimes, especially if you know you're fatigued and you're not doing well, it's better not to do that. I do know a few people that got well, literally, by not eating any later than 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, because that was what they could handle. But you will learn that by becoming sensitive to your own body, eating at the correct time, eating too fast. My husband's had problems this week with eating and not being aware of what he's eating, because he's talking to so many people and he's so involved in their lives. And he's eating fast because he wants to meet an appointment, or he's eating fast because he's all enthusiastic and invigorated with the present conversation he's through, and he thinks, what did I eat? So he's had a few little problems that I've kind of had to help him with, but he's hanging in there, fortunately, thanks to everybody's prayers. And I do the same thing. Too refined of foods. The area of refined foods, oh me. When we're in a hurry and we feel like we've got so much to do, it's so much easier to eat the ready, prepared, and the overly refined foods.